Sairam, dear listeners, we have with us once again in our studios Dr. Sam Sandweiss. I'm sure you know about him, and you certainly must have heard our conversation with him recorded on an earlier occasion, and I'm sure it has been broadcast and rebroadcast many, many times. And now we have the opportunity to hear him talk to us again. And welcome, Sam, to our studios. And I have many, many things to talk to you about, but I'll pick one topic today. And if it's okay with you, I would like to focus on late Dr. John Hislop. How is that with you? Over to you.
That's fine with me, and it's nice being with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you can always walk in. This is Swami's home, and as Swami says, no invitations are required. Okay, let me see how to begin. I would like to see if we can find out something about the man. He has written many books. They are familiar to us. But we don't seem to know much about the man. And it is necessary to know something about him, especially for the younger generation who have come to Swami in more recent times. Let me tell you how I see Hislop's place in the Sai history. I see him as one of a trio made up of Howard Moffat, Kasturi Howard Moffat, whom Swami used to refer to as the great Australian tiger, and he lived to a ripe old age, then late Mr. Kasturi and late Dr. John Hislop. Howard Moffat made Swami well-known down under, as they say, and Hislop carried Swami's message to America, and of course Kasturi made Swami very well-known all over the place through his charming talks and wonderful books. And they were the first three messengers of Sai. And since you are from America and you knew Dr. Hislop at least towards the end of his life, I would like to trouble you a little bit to rack your brains and tell us what you know about him. Just to get started, I would like to ask you, when did you first meet him? And was there any special circumstance, or it was just a normal, casual meeting?
Well, first I'd like to offer what I say to Swami and pray that he allows me to represent Dr. Hislop, or as friends know him, Jack, well, because he was a wonderful devotee. And sometimes Swami lets us see a good devotee, to see what a good devotee looks like. And it proved that way with me and Jack. I grew to understand him and appreciate him, especially during his last year of life, when I and people around San Diego took care of him while he was going through the dying process. So I hope I can represent him well, because he was really a very fine man. When did I first meet him? I first came to Swami in 1972. I think Jack came to Swami about 1968, if I'm not mistaken. And it must have been soon after 72 that I met him. I don't have a clear memory of exactly when or the circumstances, but because there were just a few of us at that time and we were asked to speak about Swami, our paths crossed quite a bit. We became much closer in about 1975, when Swami started the Sai organization, the Sai organization in different countries. So the Satcha Sai Institute, or the Satcha Sai Council of the U.S. was started in 1975, and Jack was the president at that time. And so that's when I began to get to know him a little bit better.
I believe Hislop was a PhD. If so, in what subject? And tell us a little bit about his professional background, if you happen to know
anything.
Yes,
and I don't know that very well. He was a PhD. You know, sometimes Swami referred to him as having six PhDs.
Yes, Jack would laugh. I heard Jack mention that.
And he said he didn't know where he got all of those. Although I heard stories that for the previous five lifetimes he was in the Himalayas as a as a sadhu. I don't know where that came from, but he had also heard such stories. I think it was from UCLA, the PhD, and I think it was in either education or business. I don't know for sure. You see, when Jack was young, he was born in Canada. When he was a young boy, as early as 16, he would search for God, and he would leave home and take long trips. He was a very bright and very powerful man. And so he could run off, I think, I'm not quite sure the first big trip, I think it was Fiji, but I'm not sure. He would go off and he would try to stay with holy men or gurus, and he was just attracted to learning about spirituality. And he would come back, and he was a very good businessman, and I believe it was mostly in real estate investment and development. And he made his money quickly, and then he would come for just a brief period of time to make his money, which he could do easily, evidently, and then off he would run. And he went all over the world. When Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the originator of Transcendental Meditation, came to the U.S., he asked Jack to coordinate that program. And Jack did take on that position for a brief period until he felt it wasn't his path. But he stayed with many different gurus. I don't think he's well known for his business transactions, although I think he was extremely successful, and it only served his purpose so that he could go off to find out about spirituality. He met a Burmese master in meditation, and he spent a number of years going back and forth. He would spend a few months at a time, he and his wife, Victoria.
Going back and forth to where?
To Burma, mm-hmm. And he would then study with this Burmese master. And he told me that this master was actually pretty good, and that he could he would move into meditation into a place where no more body, so that he went deep enough into the self where it was he realized he wasn't the body. And
that was the master or Hislop?
Hislop. He could fall very deep into his self. And he was interested in Ramana Maharshi and a path of inner exploration and understanding of self. He didn't speak much about it, but he evidently could fall very deep into his self. And he liked this master, and while in the process of going every year to see this person, he heard about Swami. And what interested him was that he heard of a person that could change another person, and that person wouldn't change back. That was very important for Jack. He would tell me that a lot. I heard that you would be with this person, and there would be some transformation, and you wouldn't turn back. You wouldn't change back into your old self. So we went to see Swami. And
any idea how he came to hear about Swami?
Annalisa Rajagopal, I believe, was the contact, or Indra Devi, one of the two. Annalisa Rajagopal knew Krishnamurti,
yes,
in Ojai, and was interested in him, and I think that there was some connection. That I'm not quite sure of the connection. But she was also a spiritual aspirant, and I think it was her that told Jack about Swami. And Swami, and Jack described his first contact with Swami in an unusual way. He said he was sitting in a room in his first meeting.
Well, in India or in America?
In India. Mm-hmm. He had come, and Swami came into the room, and he went deep into himself. He described it that way, way deep into his an experience of self. He was taken with Swami's beautiful movement and just the radiation of Swami. And he went very, very deep, and he said he felt in his dry Western heart a slight movement, subtle like the wind from the fluttering wings of a butterfly. That's how he described it. And he said he recognized it as love. And then he said to himself, who could be outside as love and also reside in my heart as love? This must be God. That's actually, immediately, this must be God. The resident in my heart is love. And he was just taken with Swami immediately. He went back the next year to see the Burmese master, and the the master asked him about Swami, and Jack told him how great Swami was. And the Burmese master told Jack that he shouldn't see him anymore. Evidently, there's still some ego and struggle amongst even great masters. And Jack said, well, that would be impossible. And so he left that meditation, and a year or two later, the master, Burmese master, died. So Jack was with Swami and then poured himself into Swami and offered himself completely. And that is what I began to know about Jack, that he had this steady and very deep conviction and love for Swami and was ready to serve. And he became the first president of the council. He ruled with a strong hand. He was a very strong personality, rather private. So I didn't get to know him on a personal level very well. Very intelligent, decisive. He would write letters on his typewriter, and they would go all out, and people would get stirred by the letters. He was just trying to bring all of us together in some kind of working unit. And very forceful personality and attractive person. And he could speak on Vedanta and on the nature of desire and the importance of gaining sense control and things of that nature.
He was a well-read man.
Beg your pardon?
He was a well-read man.
He was well-read and very intelligent. And he had, especially in spirituality, he had years and years of search and had been with some of the well-known spiritual people around the world. So he understood.
Going back to his, first contact and with Swami and his impressions of Swami, do I get it right if I say that what really captivated him and what he found unusual was that Swami stirred love in his heart?
That was it.
Experience he never got through meditation.
He felt that he had he would call it a dry Western heart. And he wondered what could make it stir, what could bring love into that dry one. And it was a huge revelation to him that his heart started to stir with Swami, and he was loving Swami so much. And you could see the love in Swami so much. Well, he just turned his life to Swami. He would follow him anywhere. He said, I would follow him anywhere.
Has he ever shared publicly or in private any experience of his which highlights and illustrates in a poignant way Swami's love to him? It's one thing to say Swami is the embodiment of love,
yes,
and things like that. Did he have any personal experience that really deeply touched him and moved him, apart from this experience in meditation when he was deep into himself?
There are a number of them. He was present at a time when Elsie Cowan, one of the first Americans to come to see Swami, and her husband Walter came, and Walter died, I think it was in Chennai.
Yes, Madras, that's right.
Madras. So, Walter wrote about it, and Jack was there and observed this whole thing. And Swami would take Jack with him a lot, so he was in the car with Swami. He was taken with the raising of Walter, but I remember he was talking about how Swami was speaking at the microphone, and at the same time, Jack said, at the same time he had gone to the hospital. I think he was in two places at once. I think he had seen some of these extraordinary phenomena that were not only showed Swami having command over time and space and life and death, but they were used to love people and to give people gifts and to make them happy. I think the strongest experience that Jack came back to over and over again, he was riding in a car, in the front seat of a car, and Swami was in the back with two men. And he turned around and looked at Swami, and Swami's form had changed into Krishna. And he said he saw this exquisitely beautiful form, so beautiful. He said that no artist or no writer could ever capture it. He said he just looked at that form and it twisted your heart and you just loved it. He said this over and over. He would go back to this experience and he couldn't, the only thing he could say is, Swami, what is the blue color? The other people obviously didn't see this, you know, because they didn't pay any attention to it. And
sometimes these are kept hidden from the other's view. Shirdi Baba also has done this. Mm-hmm. It's a very private revelation to one blessed soul.
Well, it just went into his heart and it stayed there. Even during the process of his dying, if you ever wanted to see Jack gain strength, when people are dying, they lose strength. And yet you talk with him about Baba and he would rise up like a lion. He would still roar. I'll tell stories about that and about his love for Swami. Obviously, his love for Swami as he was going through the death process. But then it was some years later that Swami said this was actual experience I gave you of Krishna. I think I never heard of any other specifics. Maybe it'll come to me. But just being around Swami, he felt that kind of extraordinary love. Swami just has to smile or just wink an eye. And today he smiled at me and I was so happy. It's hard to explain what energy there is there. And he doesn't have to do a major extraordinary. He just has to look at you.
I'll tell you something that somebody said which sums it all. He says, no man on earth can smile like Swami, and that's absolutely true.
Absolutely.
Getting back to Jack, a little bit of personal detail. Did he have any children, family?
He did. Mm. I never met them. At the end of his life, we knew he had a daughter, and his daughter came to visit. Mm. And I don't know about the others. We didn't know much about Jack's private life.
He was not much of a family man, was he?
I can't tell. I think
because he was a very private person.
He was a private person, and because he had this, he was bent on the spiritual path, so that a lot of people didn't understand him. If you were in the world, and I think his family was, I think his daughter was in the world, she didn't quite understand the intensity of his search and of his love for spirituality. So, you know, he would always say it this way: never put your hand in the stream of karma. Never dip your hand in the stream of karma. So he was always aware of detachment. Don't get caught with anybody, get snarled in the world. And so with that, he was a loving person. I don't know what his relationship with his daughter was, but we never saw much of her except near the end of his life.
Before we come to his memorable last days, I would like to go back to his work as the president of the Sai organization in America. There are two or three aspects to that. One is the organizational aspect and so on and so forth. But what I would like to know is, did he have any particular vision of, you know, spreading the message of Swami's love to American mainstream? And if so, what was it? Because surely it was not just organization. The organization was just a means to an end, and the end must clearly be, at least it should have been, spreading Swami's message of love to America, which I presume America needs. I'm sure you'll agree with
and
that.
And that's a very good question. Hmm. Jack was a very practical person, and he knew that the organization could get parochial and closed, and especially because there were so many Indians who were devotees. And so,
you mean not Native American Indians?
Not Native American Indians. So he knew that people coming to a center would immediately see that it was a little strange for American culture, and he was always trying to push for it to be a little bit more Western. In fact, he pushed a little too hard at times, and he wanted 50% English budget and 50%, and he got beaten up by it. You know, the thing is, he was a powerful, strong personality and very strong in his thoughts and independent. And through this dance with the Sai organization, with people, he just started to soften, you know. He would want to be a dictator at some time or say, I want this happen, that happen. But you can get blasted by anybody. The poorest little beggar can come up and roar and yell at you and scream at you. So he got plenty of that, and he softened through that. And then he had visions that the avatars here, of course, Let's start developing our speakers at the center. Everybody should give a little 15-minute talk or a 5-minute talk, be able to express something about Swami. We went through that. And no matter what we did, the centers never changed very much. They didn't get any bigger, and they didn't get any smaller, and there were a few of them. One time, Jack was frustrated. This was a kind of a funny story, and he came to Swami and he says, Swami, what is it with these centers, you know?
Now, how many years after starting with this? You said that in the mid-70s this started. So when did his frustration manifest?
This must have been about 1980 or something like that.
Okay, 5 years later.
But I don't know the dates well.
Roughly,
I know he came to Swami and he said, what is your idea about these centers? There are just a few of them. They're not growing, and there's a lot of quibbling. You know, people are arguing, and there's a lot of ego, and they're struggling. I should sing the bhajan. I shouldn't sing a bhajan. I don't like you. You don't like me. He says, maybe we should call it quits with these centers. And he says, Swami rose up and says, Hislop, something to the effect, are you crazy? He became really very strong with Hislop. Says, if it wasn't for these centers, the world would be in a much worse shape. Hislop could never understand, what are we doing in the centers? It's just a few straggly centers around here and very few people. It must be that when we are trying to take to a spiritual path, that the energy is generated must be something that we can't see, but must be extraordinary. So we must go and we must do this. And even though it was not the result of his rational mind understanding, he just took to the task, and he would go any place and every place to speak about Swami. And people recognized him as quite a authoritative person. He spoke with a certain authority and a certain knowledge from lots of experience, and they loved listening to him. So he was invited all over the place. He crisscrossed. He said, Swami said this, would describe him this way, crisscrossed the United States over and over. And then he was invited all over the world, and he would speak about Swami. And he would go, he just gave himself to
did they
go
have
anyplace.
Frequent flyers program in those days?
Well, I never asked how many miles he accumulated, but I'm sure there were a lot.
Okay. Now we come to the memorable period of his life, which I presume was the last few years. First of all, when did he get afflicted with illness? How many years before his death? And what exactly was the nature of his illness? And how long did he suffer from it?
Well, he kept all that away from us. We didn't know that he was ill.
But at some point it must have become noticeable.
It did. I could see that he was a little less steady on his feet, but still he was going to all kinds of meetings and speaking. But about 9 months prior to his death, I began to see. He was invited to go to Japan. And
where did he live?
He lived just south of San Diego, in a city called Chula Vista, which is just really southern part of San Diego, right near the border of Mexico, Tijuana, Mexico. And he lived very simply. You see, he had some money. He was a very good businessman, so he was a wealthy man. But he lived in a very simple apartment and not a very upbeat part of the city. It was just mediocre to a little bit on the downside in terms of the upkeep of the neighborhood. And when you went into his house, it was clean, but he had lawn furniture in his house. It was very as if he didn't have much attachment to it. He didn't show off anything in terms of material wealth or material status. It had no meaning to him. And so when you went into his house, it was kind of an unusual house in that respect.
He was truly detached.
He seemed to be detached, and it made no difference to him where he would live or engaging in any opulence in any way. He had actually lawn furniture. So I remember he was invited to go to Japan for a talk, and he told it to me this way. He said, well, old boy, he would sometimes call us, in a very friendly way, well, old boy. I was asked to go to Japan, and I wrote Swami, I'm not too keen in going. And then Swami sent back just one word, go. So I picked him up, and I was going to take him down to the airport to get his plane. He was dressed in a nice suit, But by that time, he was weakening. And we were, he was getting a little more forgetful. We looked around for his keys, and we found it in the lock. He had put it in the lock, and he was as cheery as could be. I mean, he was going ahead with this. But as I started to walk with him down, he was living on a second floor, walk with him down the stairway, he could hardly take that stairway. And I had to grab his arm and steady him. And I was alarmed at that. I didn't know he was that weak. And I said, "Jack, are you sure you can make this trip? And you sure you're going to go?" He said, "Swami told me to go, and Swami will take care of me." It was almost innocent, childlike. Swami just said to go. But I'm a doctor, and I knew Jack, and here he was really very weak. We went to the airport, and I said, "Excuse me." I went to the desk and arranged for a wheelchair to meet Jack at every airport. And I wasn't sure how Jack was going to take it, if it was hurt his pride or whatnot. So I went back and said, "Jack, I don't know if you will accept this or not, but I've arranged for a wheelchair to meet you." He says, "You think I need it, old boy?" I said, "Yes." He says, "Okay." It was strange how he just took it, just as a matter of course. But I was very worried about him.
And the year was?
This was 1995. It must have been about January. He went to Japan and he gave 35 talks in 10 days.
35 talks?
In 10 days.
Jesus
Christ.
He
said, "I was able to stand up there when I was talking about Swami, but I was a little tired afterward."
And each talk must have been at least 1 hour. Translation?
Probably. This was no easy task that Swami had him do at this time. Swami, of course, knew what was happening, and Jack was just willing to give every ounce that he had. Well, he came back, and the first night I called him the next morning and said, "Jack, how'd you do? How are you sleeping?"
Well, he was away in Japan for 10 days?
He was away for 10 days.
And his wife went with him?
No. She stayed back.
He went alone in this condition of health?
Yes. Now, his wife was developing Alzheimer's.
So she was
having a medical problem, and he always thought that he would be able to take care of her and that she would die first and he would be able to give that support.
Was it in a very advanced stage at that time?
No. We could all see that she wasn't the same person. Lovely story. I was with Jack as we started to take care of him. She was in the same bedroom and next bed, and he was in this bed, and I would come over frequently. And he was very weak at this time, and she didn't talk very much, and she was getting simpler in her capacity to speak. But we were looking at Swami's Vibhuti. I said, "Can I put a little on your chest?" And so I put some in my hand and I rubbed it on his chest, nice and sweet. And he was such a sweet, loving person. And she sat up and she says, "That's devotion." She responded, you know, unusual that even in course of a dementia, and I've seen it in a number of people, when they have such deep relationship with Swami, their spiritual awareness can still be. It can also be taken by such a ravaging illness. But there it surprised me that she could say something like, "Well, here, Jack just did come back from Japan, and I gave him a call." I says, "How was your night?" He says, "Well, it was not so good."
Did you meet him on arrival?
No, I didn't.
Someone else took care of him?
Somebody else met him and took him back to his... But we were all close by this time, and I was getting worried about him, so I was calling him. And I said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, he got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and when he was going back to bed, he fell, and he couldn't get up. And so he laid there all night long." I said, "Jack, you didn't tell me you were this weak." He says, "Well, old boy, it's been happening to me, and... it was all right. I got enough strength in the early morning to lift myself and finally get back to bed." I says, "What are you talking about, Jack?" So I rushed down there. I mean, you know, he just wouldn't let on.
Was any doctor visiting him and checking him up?
No, No doctor whatsoever. I says, come on, we're going to the emergency room. So got him in the car, and we went to the emergency room. This was an unusual event. I mean, he was wheeled in. He went into onto one of his gurneys and went into the emergency room. There were a number of beds on each side, and curtains were pulled. And he and I sat, and we just started talking about Swami. And, of course, he would talk about Swami, and he would just light up. So we were enjoying ourselves, and we were laughing some of the stories. And I would ask Jack some of the stories, and he would tell me of how Swami saved him from a car wreck, and how Swami came to him one time when he was at the ashram and was asked to speak to a large group. Swami came up to him afterward and said, "You did pretty well, except for this one question. When this man asked you this question, and you confused him a little bit." So Jack says, "Swami, how do you know that?" He says, "Well, I was there." He says, "I didn't see you." He says, "Oh, in what form did you come? Did you come in a form of God like Ishwara?" And Swami says, "No, I'm just omnipresent. Omnipresence." And we would laugh at the story. You know, I says, "Jack, isn't it amazing? Here, the two of us were sitting talking about these extraordinary stories, and the doctor was coming in and tapping on his chest, and they were looking in his eyes and looking in his ears, and the people next to him were coughing, and another person was throwing up, and we were just sitting there laughing about the stories." This story, he told me how he was in a car going back from the Vrindavan ashram, and it was late at night. And he saw headlights coming very fast down the road. It was just a one-lane road. And he looked to the right, and there were just rocks all over. And he looked to the left, and there's a huge ditch. And he knew it was his end. And he closed his eyes. And when he opened it, the car was in back. And they were still going. And the driver says,
"But you missed out on a crucial sentence of his." He says in his writings, "There was a taxi driver mad, and coming just in front of us was another taxi with another mad driver."
And then Swami called him and said, he said, "Thank you, Swami, for saving my life." And Swami says, "And you didn't even remember to call on me, or you didn't remember to say my name." You know, this is so extraordinary. I was talking to my brother, who has come here a number of times, and he's become quite an atheist. It's strange how people's lives go. And I was saying, you know, I'm beginning to believe that the whole external world, when we see it through the mind, is just a projection of the mind. And he said, "Oh, yeah, Sam, it's just a projection of your mind. Well, if you walked across the street and the car came at you, would that just be a projection?" And I was thinking about that. But what this Jack Hislop story says is that from the mind, everything is a projection, and we're in that level of reality. But if we were in a divine level of reality, the car wouldn't hit us. I mean, we would have complete command of it. At this stage, everything is a projection, and we live and die in the projection. But Swami was showing Jack that at another level, it is a projection, and the world from divine level is a projection of God's will. It's just, and it has no real basis. It's just a projection. That is so mind-boggling for us rationalists to try to grasp. So we were talking of such things, and I says, "Jack, you think really one day we can rise into the omnipresence that Swami is in when he saw you?" He says, "Well, that's what Swami tells us, old boy. I haven't been there yet, but I know it can happen. I know it can happen in a flash." And he would talk like that with strength and with vitality, you know. And here we were in the hospital, and he could hardly walk. So they couldn't. They saw his feet were swollen. They found that he had some diabetes, but they couldn't see anything more severe than that. And they said, "Go to your regular doctor. It looks like there's life-threatening illness here." So the next day, he went to his doctor, and they did some tests. They found he had lymphoma, a cancer of the lymphatic system, pretty far advanced. So they found
the throat.
No, lymphatic means all through the body. The lymph nodes have cancerous growths, and he must have had some large growths in his abdomen, and it must be spreading. so that at some stage they're microscopic, but they're invading, and because that process is going in the body, it's draining all the strength. Hey, he didn't have the strength to stand. And such a powerful fellow. So we found out that he
had... How old was he at this point of time?
89.
Oh, 89?
Yes.
Pretty advanced. Hmm.
And I took him to a top cancer specialist in San Diego to have a talk. He wanted to talk it through. He said, of course, I'll do whatever Swami says. And so we wrote a letter to Swami. And then we went to the cancer specialist, and he says, well, at your age and at the advanced stage and the kind of virility of the process, there doesn't look like there's anything to do. And Jack says, well, I would just as well give it to Swami, and he'll take care of me. That's how it was. There was no change in his affect. In fact, I thought that it was unusual because, you know, psychiatrists say, well, when a person hears about their death, there's denial, and then there's anger, and then there's depression, and then there's withdrawal, and then, you know, there are all kinds of stages. I just saw Jack say, well, okay, I'll give this to Swami. At one time during the process, I said, Jack, aren't you angry? Aren't you upset that such a strong person as you has to see himself dwindle away so slowly? And he looked at me, he said, should I be angry? I said, no, Jack, you shouldn't be angry. You know, you have to act and ask it like a young child would, so innocent. Should I be? Well, it was something to see the devotees rally around Jack at that point. We had people who would come and clean his place. We had people that would come prepare any food that he wanted. We had a person who would be his private secretary and help him organize his papers, pay bills, do whatever business he had to do. So then a few doctors in our area would come, and we would visit him regularly, and we would do whatever we could. We were all surrounding him, and he, at that point, he turned into just loving, loving person. He says, I see Swami's miracle. These are all Swami's angels. It's so wonderful to see this. It's so beautiful to
see.
So
he was fully conscious and in possession of his faculties?
He could recognize...
At least mental faculties.
He could recognize that he was slow in his faculties. I mean, he had such a sharp mind. He was so powerful in his thinking. And I said, you know, I wondered how a man watching himself go slowly and lose his faculty slowly. Why, Swami, wouldn't you take Jack immediately into ecstasy, pull him out of this terrible, you know, body that is sort of decaying in front of us? And why wouldn't you release him quickly? But no, slowly. And I would ask Jack, can you feel that you're not thinking quite as clearly? He says, oh, of course, I can't keep my mind focused like I used to. It's hard for me to do that, and sometimes I have to watch a television set to just keep my mind focused on something. Is it upsetting? Yes, I would love to have my power and serve Swami. I would love to serve Swami. And at that point, I said, Jack, would you like us to have would you like to talk to the devotees, and would you like us to have some interviews? I was very careful not to take advantage and to do anything sensational that would take advantage of Jack, but he wanted very much, yes, let's talk about Swami. So we had three sessions where we videoed him, and they're very, very touching.
Where, in his house?
In his house, because he had the nasal oxygen by this time, he could hardly walk, but he would sit, he wanted to talk about Swami, and it is so touching to see a person in this state want nothing more than to talk about Swami.
Was the speech clear?
His speech was still clear. At times you could see that it was a little slurring or a little bit not as decisive, not as quick, not as strong. But no, he was clear, and he could talk about Swami and a little more slowly, but he had the same authority and power when he spoke, even at late stage.
Can I ask you a question here? When he spoke, was he sort of in a different state where he was very radiating power and not exhibiting any signs of his illness and weakness? Was there some kind of an inner strength that was sustaining during that period of speech?
You could see that when he was in touch with Swami and talking about Swami, he would have some unusual power. You could still see that he was weakened, but he was animated. And any time I asked him to describe the Krishna, you know, his vision would go in, he would see Krishna, and he said, oh, it would twist your heart. It was so beautiful. He would rise up. It was something to see, but he was just a strong person. So if you came to him, if anybody came to him, he'd want to give something to them. And he could speak spirituality and help people on their path when they were just sitting with him. They would ask a question and he would be able to give an answer that was not a pat answer, that was a thought out answer and provocative answer, and would engage a person. So he continued with this kind of strength.
The reason why I asked you the question about the force of his speech is the following. There was a period a couple of years ago when Swami appeared a little more frail than he is now. And then he would get up to give a discourse. The first two words would be, you know, not very strong. And within 2 minutes, he would be his full force. And at the end of it all, he will go back to coughing and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And it is, you know, very amazing. All of us have seen it here.
Uh-huh.
Frequently. And during that period, perfect. Just before, he would be a different person. Just afterwards, you would wonder, did he speak like that? And that's, of course, a drama. But then I was just wondering whether that sort of inner power was articulated.
Well, with Swami, from my point of view, it's altogether... Because I think that Swami has us see him in such a frail way. I mean, it tears us up.
No, but then, and, you know, that power of divinity, was it animating his love? That was my point.
Well, yes, I think it did. And you can see, because you have these videos, I don't think that he could rise as strong as Swami.
No.
But you see, I've seen, and we've heard Swami during this period where his speech will get a little garbled. You know, it doesn't look like he's holding back, trying to hide any weakness. In fact, he looks like he's rubbing it into us in some way. You know, he looks so frail and so weak, and it takes him so long to move sometimes. Of course, one time I asked him in an interview, he looked so vibrant. It was such a disjoint from the way he looked on the porch, so slow. I said, Swami, are you playing a game with us? You know, he says, yes, playing. Who knows what it means? But I don't think Swami holds back, and sometimes his speech sounds not with the same clarity from my point of view. And I don't know. There are times when I know that he rises in a certain way, but I don't think he's trying to keep anything from us. We're just seeing somebody showing this as if it's not his body. And he's just going through whatever it is.
Getting back to the, you know, Hislop's sort of slowly losing his capacities, I am reminded of something that Narasimhamurthy told me about Kasturi, who was here in his last days in the hospital. And Narasimhamurthy used to go and see him all the time, every day. And Kasturi would say, you know, one by one I am losing the senses. Swami is taking it away one by one. And I am having fewer senses now. It was a process of sinking where he was losing one by one his senses. Either he was surrendering or it was being taken away. And I was reminded of that.
Well, that's very interesting, because I think in Chapter 8 of the Gita, there's a section on how to die, where you leave the senses and you move yourself into heart, and then you go into the third eye, and through Om you move. And I'll talk about that. That's interesting how that happened with Jack. But for some of us who have practiced some sense of detachment and can keep some awareness as we go through this, it may not frighten us so much that we can watch it happen, where the senses stop and still we're aware of inner presence, inner self, and we can move it to certain areas, or it moves it if we're depending upon our stage of advancement, spiritual advancement, you move to the heart, move to the third eye. Well, Jack didn't seem, you know, one time he voiced this. I was with him. He looked a little bit saddened, and he said, "Sam, I hope I'm not disappointing you." This was his worry. He wanted to, for me and the others, that he should be a good representation of Swami. It was so, that was heartrending to see that, that this was on his mind as he had to deal with this process of the body shutting down slowly. One day I called and I says, "Well, Jack, what's happening with you?" He says, "Well, I'm sitting here on the side of my bed with my legs over the side of the bed." I said, "Can you walk?" He says, "I don't think so." I said, "What is harder, Jack, going to Japan and giving 35 lectures in 10 days or walking today?" He says, "Well, old boy, walking today is harder." And I'd say, "Jack, aren't you upset a little to see this happen to you?" "Well, maybe I have some more karma to go through." Evidently, to see, really, it must be grace to watch this happen and still have devotion to Swami, to realize it was just a gift of his, and to allow ourselves to release more and more of the fear and
he
everything.
He knew he was dying, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he knew he was dying, and it didn't bother him. He said, "Whatever Swami wants, I'm putting myself in his hands." So to see a devotee live it at a time when it should be most fearful, where so many things are happening to the body, you're losing your power, you're losing your stature, your position, your command, your mental command, people who have identified themselves with their mind, with their body. He had all of this, and he was seeing it slowly go, and to release it, continue to release it into Swami so that he says, "Well, old boy, let's just go through this. Remember," I said, "do you see Swami today?" He says, "No, I'm having difficulty with my mind. But you know what, old boy? Sometimes it's more important to know what not to hold on to than what to hold on to." And he said, "You have to be very careful. Don't dip your hand in the stream of karma. Don't get attached to the dying process." This was remarkable to see that we can maintain that kind of spiritual position as we're going through the transition.
Yeah, I want to go back to the remark that he made. Why did he tell you, "Sam, I hope I am not disappointing you"? Any idea why he said that?
Yes, because out of love, he wants to show us, he wanted to show us how to die correctly, and he wanted to represent Swami well. Even then, you know, I've heard Swami say, I was going to speak to the students, and he told me you should tell them this, and one of them was that you're so close to the avatar, but you don't realize you're like a frog sitting on a lotus. If you can't see that, you can't see how close and how much I'm holding you, then at least look at the world, see how it's all impermanent and passing. And if you can't see that, then see why all of these people are coming here, because they're coming for love. They want the love. He said, if you can't see, the outer world is impermanent, so don't touch it too much. Don't get too much involved. Then at least look at all these people. Why are they coming here? They're coming because of love. Understand the love. And if you can't see that, then know that these people are watching you. And because you're close to Swami, you're representing Swami. So represent me well. And I think Jack understood that. You know, he was a representative of Swami, and he wanted to represent Swami well. And so with his last breath, he would give an interview. He wanted those around him to see that Swami was great, and that he would do everything he could to express that.
Now, come to the last moments.
Last moments are interesting. I came to his apartment at about 6:30 or so.
Morning?
In the afternoon, in the early evening. And in these unusual coincidences, just about everybody that was taking care of him, the major people that were coordinating different areas, the people that had cooked, and the people that his secretary that was helping, and myself and my wife Sharon and one of my daughters, we all showed up at the same time. Our cars came at the same time. So we went into the house, and there was Jack. He had lost consciousness, and he looked like his breathing was labored. And so it was kind of sad to see him.
His wife was there?
His wife was there.
She was aware of what's going on?
She was. and we were soothing her and paying attention. I looked around the apartment for a tape recording machine to play some bhajans, you know, because he looked like he was struggling. But he had an old, rusted out tape recording machine. It was a funny little. And so I stood at the head of the bed and I just started to chant Om. And I said, Swami, there must be prescribed mantras at this time, but I'm not, versed in that. So everything is an Om. Let me offer this. Om, Om. And then everybody started to come. They heard the Om, and Victoria sat by the side of his bed and held his hand. And we all came, and there was this resounding Om. Om. It's quite a sight, because Jack was, who we'd all loved, we'd seen him be such a powerful force, such a radiating force. There he was, last breath, and struggling. Om. We did Oming for about 1 minute, and his mantra was Om Sai Ram. He didn't open his eyes, but you could see that he heard it because his body changed. He actually, it looked as if he was attending. Om. And as we did this, you could first see the attending, and then you could see the relaxing. The whole body started to relax. Om. Om. And within a moment, it was after probably 1 minute of us chanting, he left into this Om, and we could feel him in the Om. It was the most powerful experience of Om I had ever experienced, because we could feel him leave in the Om. And then we just kept on Oming for another few minutes. No more breathing. Body just settled. And we knew that Jack had merged with Swami, because we all felt the merging. It was extraordinary. Last moment. So, a good buddy, a good love to our good friend Jack.
A small postscript happened in the morning in the veranda. Swami had come out. I was sitting, not yet the vice chancellor, so I was sort of somewhat behind. And I think Robert Bruce was sitting not very far from me. Swami came and stood near him. Your friend, where is he? Hislop, Hislop. Swami said, Hislop, Swami, he is gone. Swami said, no, he has come to me.
Ah, very beautiful. I wrapped up some of the gifts that Swami had given Jack. You know, he gave him a ring with Prema's picture on. He gave him a crucifix with the original wood of the crucifix and how Jesus actually looked. And many different items. So I brought back to Swami and I gave it to Swami, and Swami said he was very steady. 15 years of constant meditation on Swami. Very, very steady. And so I brought some of his ashes and went down to the Chitravati.
Did he ask that it be immersed there, or?
He wanted to be cremated, and we didn't get any more specific detail. I don't think he minded where it would be, but we spread it out onto the ocean, and I took a little bit here and then put it into the Chitravati River.
I can tell you a small incident. I saw on the board that you are going to speak in this very building, which in those days used to function as a lecture hall. You have spoken, yes. I have spoken, and the word got around that you're going to speak about Hislop. So 10 o'clock is when the talks begin. And I said, I should miss this, I must hear this. So I come at 10 o'clock, and I couldn't get anywhere near the door. The place was full, so I had to go back. So now you have to tell me, after all these years, what you said that morning in this room or in this building.
I should tell you?
Yeah, you spoke about Hislop that day. So what
it
did
must
you
have
tell?
Been this story.
No, this story.
Probably
right?
This story. It's a very moving story. But it's such a... We had a chance to see a devotee who had given himself to Swami, and the way he... how much he gave to Swami.
You know, it's not very often that people die to the chant of Om. which is the ultimate chant. And as Swami says somewhere, rather humorously, Om is God's telephone number.
Well, yes, I didn't realize this, but in Chapter 8 of the Gita,
yeah, exactly, I was going to come to that. So, you know, that is the best way of departing. And even if he had lost his, apparently lost his faculties, he was conscious of Om because you said he responded. And there's no better way to go. He who remembers me when he departs merges in me.
And I guess we do a good service if we're around a dying brother and sister, brother or sister, and we can chant this Om, because there's no question it had
Om is powerful. The representation of the source. So he goes back where he came from, and I don't think there was a better send-off and there was a better reception. You sent him off and he was received. I can tell you that he was received.
We said,
because I heard it.
That's wonderful. Swami said one more lifetime for Jack.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, come on.
And Swami said, during Prem Sai period. Maybe. He said, your next lifetime will be very good. And Jack said, but this lifetime was very good, Swami. I was with you. But he said, one more lifetime for Jack.
Well, we have been conversing for a long time and we just didn't know the passage of time. It's almost 1 hour. So at this point of time, I would like to, not just formally, but out of my heart, thank you for sharing your recollections of a very great devotee, the like of whom we don't see very often, and whose dying moments were a great inspiration for me to hear about, and I'm sure all those who hear this will also be greatly moved, touched, and inspired. Because I think his last portion of his life demonstrated two things, or three things. First is, don't bother about the physical affliction, try to serve Swami till the end. Second, don't get too much attached. And third, try to focus on the primordial all the time. I think, I hope I have summarized his, I would say, perception of Swami, his understanding of his love, and his eagerness to talk about Swami till his last breath. That is something amazing. And even as his life was ebbing, he said, call them, I want to talk about Swami. That's just extraordinary. And it was really very kind of you to capture all those glorious moments. The story of devotees is as vital as the story of the Lord, because as Swami says, without devotee, the story of the Lord is incomplete. It would be like a party to which nobody came.
Yes, right.
Well, you have the last word.
Well, no, it was a privilege. I thank Swami for letting us recollect and having the experience of such a nice devotee. And of course, Swami, our continuing closeness with you. We pray for that all the time. Sai Ram.
Thank you. Sai Ram.